between them and inhaled until he burned his lips. A decorated, lopped-off top end of a spruce tree stood on a table in the corner, attempting to glitter. He thought about the Christmas dinner in Dai. It was 2 years after the end of the war, and the Serbs had withdrawn from what once had been Vukovar. The Croatian authorities had packed them into the Hotel International in Zagreb. He had asked lots of people if they knew where Georgi's family had ended up, and one day he had met another refugee who knew that Georgi's mother had died during the siege, and that he and his father had moved to Dai, a small border town not far from Vukovar. On December 26th, he caught the train to Osijek, and then from there to Dai. He talked to the conductor, who confirmed that the train would go on to Borovo, the terminal, and would be back in Dai by 6:30. It was 2 o'clock when he alighted in Dai. He asked for directions to the address, which was a low apartment building as grey as the town. He went into the hallway, found the door, and before ringing said a silent prayer that they would be at home. His heart was pounding fast as he heard light footsteps inside. Georgi opened the door. He hadn't changed much. Paler, but the same blonde curls, blue eyes, and heart-shaped mouth that had always made him think of a young god. The smile in his eyes was gone, however, like a broken light bulb. "Don't you recognize me, Georgi?" he asked after a while. "We lived in the same town. We went to the same school." Georgi furrowed his brow. "Did we? Wait, the voice. You must be Serge Domac. Of course, you were the fast runner. Jesus, how you've changed. But it's great to see people we knew in Vukovar. They've all gone. Not me." "No, not you, Serge." Georgi embraced him and held him for such a long time that he could feel the heat beginning to tremble through his frozen body. Then he led him into the flat. It was dark in the sparsely furnished sitting room as they sat talking about all the things that had happened and all the people they had known in Vukovar and where they were now. When he asked whether Georgi remembered Tinto the dog, Georgi gave him a rather perplexed smile. Georgi said his father would be home soon. Did Serge want to stay and eat? He looked at his watch. The train would be at the station in 3 hours. The father was very surprised to meet a visitor from Vukovar. "This is Serge," Georgi said. "Serge Dolac."
"Serge Dolac?" the father asked, scrutinizing him. "Yes. There's something familiar about you."
"Didn't I know your father, no?"
Darkness fell, and after taking their places at the table, the father gave them large white napkins and loosened his red neckerchief and tied the napkin around his neck. The father said grace, made the sign of the cross, and inclined his head to the only picture in the room, a framed photo of a woman. As Georgi and his father took their cutlery, he bowed and intoned,
"Who is this that comes from Edom, coming from Bosra, his garments stained crimson? Who is this, in glorious apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength? It is I, who announce that light has won the day. It is I, says the Lord, for I am mighty to save."
The father eyed him in astonishment. Then he passed him the dish with the large, pale pieces of meat. The meal continued in silence. The wind made the thin windows groan. After the meat, there was dessert. Palacinka, thin pancakes filled with jam and chocolate spread over the top. He hadn't had one since he was a child in Vukovar.
"Take another, dear Serge," the father said. "It's Christmas."
He checked his watch. The train would leave in half an hour. It was time. He cleared his throat, put down the napkin and stood up. "Georgi and I have been talking about all the people we remember from Vukovar. But there is one person we haven't spoken about yet," he said.
"I see,"
the father said, mystified, and smiled.
"Who is that, Serge?"
The father had turned his head a little and viewed him with one eye, as though trying to identify something he could not put his finger on. His name was Bobo. He could see in Georgi's father's eyes that now he knew. He might have been waiting for this moment. He heard his voice resound between the bare walls.
"You were sitting in the jeep and pointed him out to the Serbian commanding officer."
He swallowed.
"Bobo died."
The room went still. The father put down his cutlery.
"It was war, Serge. We all have to die."
He said this with composure, almost resignation. The father and Georgi were motionless as he took the gun from the waistband of his trousers, pointed it across the table, and fired. The explosion was brief and dry, and the father's body jerked as the chair leg scraped against the floor. The father lowered his head and stared at the hole in the napkin hanging in front of his chest. Then it was sucked into his chest as the blood spread like a red flower over the white cloth. "Look at me," he ordered, and the father automatically raised his head. The second shot made a tiny black hole in his forehead, which fell forward, hitting the plate of palachinka with a soft thud. He turned to Georgi, who was staring open-mouthed, a red line running down his cheek. It took him a second to realize that this was jam from his father's palachinka. He stuffed the pistol into the waistband of his trousers.
"You'll have to shoot me too, Serg.
I don't have any scores to settle with you."
He walked out of the sitting room and took the jacket hanging by the door. Georgi followed.
"I'll get even with you. I'll find you and kill you, if you don't kill me."
"And how will you find me, Georgi? You cannot hide.
I know who you are."
"Do you?
You think I am Serg.
But Serg Dolaj had red hair and was taller than me. And I'm not a fast runner, Georgi. But let's just be happy you don't recognize me, Georgi. It means I can spare your life."
Then he leaned forward, kissed Georgi hard on the mouth, opened the door and left. The newspapers had written about the murder, but the police had never looked for anyone. And 3 months later, one Sunday, his mother told him about a Croatian who had visited her to ask for help. The man had been unable to pay much, but he had collected some money from the family. A Serbian who had tortured his brother during the war had been found living nearby, and someone had mentioned something about the one they called the Little Redeemer. The old man burned his fingertips on the thin cigarette and swore aloud. He stood up and went to reception. Behind the boy on the other side of the glass partition was the red flag of the Salvation Army. "Could I use the phone, please?" The boy scowled at him.
"If it's a local call, yes."
"It is."
The boy pointed to a narrow office behind him, and he entered, sat down at the desk and contemplated the telephone. He thought of his mother's voice, how concerned and frightened it could be, and gentle and warm at the same time. It was like an embrace. He stood up, closed the door to reception, and punched in the number of Hotel International. She wasn't there. He didn't leave a message. The door opened.
"You're not allowed to close the door," the boy said.
"Okay?
Okay, sorry. Do you have a telephone directory?"
The boy rolled his eyes, pointed to a thick book beside the phone and left. He found John Carlson at 4 Göteborgata and dialed the number. Thea Nilsson contemplated the ringing telephone. She had locked herself in John's flat with the key he had given her. They said there was a bullet hole somewhere. She had searched and found it in the cupboard door. The man had tried to shoot John, to kill him. The thought made her strangely agitated, not frightened at all. At times she thought she would never be frightened again, not like that, not about dying. The police had been here, but they hadn't spent much time looking. No clues apart from the bullets, they had said. In the hospital, she had listened to John breathing in and out as he gazed at her. He had looked so helpless there in the large hospital bed, as though all she had to do was place a pillow over his face and he would be dead. And she had liked that, seeing him weak. Perhaps the schoolteacher in Hamsun's Victoria was right. For some women, the need to feel sympathy made them hate their strong, healthy men, and in secret they wished their husbands were cripples and dependent on their kindness. But now she was alone in his flat, and the telephone was ringing. She looked at her watch. It was the middle of the night. No one would call now. No one with honest intentions. Thea was not afraid to die, but she was afraid of this. Was it her, the woman John thought she knew nothing about? She took 2 paces toward the phone, paused. The fourth ring. It would stop after 5. She hesitated. Another ring. She surged forward and picked up the receiver.
"Yes?"
It was quiet for a moment at the other end. Then a man spoke in English.
"Sorry for calling so late. My name is Edom. Is John there?"
"No,"
she said with relief.
"He's in the hospital." "Ah, yes. I heard about what happened today. I'm an old friend and would like to visit him. Which hospital is he in?"
"Ullevål."
"Ullevål?"
"Yes. I don't know what the department is called in English. It's neurochirurgisch in Norwegian. But there's a policeman sitting outside the room and he won't let you in. Do you understand what I'm saying?"
understand? My English, it's not very... I understand perfectly. Thank you very much.
She put down the receiver and stood thinking for a long time. Then she resumed her search. They had said there were several bullet holes. He told the boy in reception at the hostel that he was going for a walk, and handed him the room key. The boy glanced at the clock on the wall showing 12:15, and told him to keep the key. He explained that he was going to lock up and go to bed soon, but the room key also opened the front door. The cold assaulted him as soon as he was outside, biting and scratching. He lowered his head and began to stride out with purpose. This was risky, definitely risky, but he had to do it. Ola Henmo, the production manager at Hafslund Energy, sat in the control room at the load dispatch center in Montebello, Oslo, thinking how great it would be to smoke while keeping an eye on the 40 screens scattered around the room. During the day, there were 12 people in here, but at night just 3. They usually sat at their own workstations, but tonight the cold outside seemed to have driven them around one desk in the middle of the room. Geir and Ebba were arguing about horses, as always, and the recent racing results. For 8 years they had been doing that, and it had never occurred to them to place separate bets. Ola was more concerned about the substation on Kirkeveien between Ullevålsveien and Sognsveien. 36% overload on T1, 29% on T2 to T4, he said. Christ, the way people are stoking up out there, Geir said. Are they frightened of freezing to death? It's night time. Why don't they snuggle up under the duvet? Sweet revenge in the third. Are you out of your mind? Folks don't turn down the heating because of that, Ebba said. Not in this country. They chuck money out the window. It's going to end in tears, Ola said. No, it won't, Ebba said. We'll just pump up more oil. I'm thinking about T1, Ola said, pointing to the screen. It's on 680 amps now. Full capacity is 500 nominal load. Relax, Ebba managed to get in, a second before the alarm went off. Oh, shit, Ola said. There she blows. Check the list and call the guys on duty.
See?
Geir said. T2's down too, and T3 just went.
Bingo,
shouted Ebba. Should we have a bet on whether T4...
Too late, she just blew,
Geir said. Ola ran his eye over the small-scale map. Okay, he sighed. Power's gone in Lower Song, Fagerborg, and Bislett. Bet you I know what's happened, Ebba said. 1,000 on cables sleeving. Geir screwed up one eye.
Meter transformer, and 500's enough.
Cut that out now,
Ola growled.
Ebba, call the fire station. I bet there's a fire up there.
Agreed, Ebba said. 200? When the light went out in the hospital room, the darkness was so total that John's first thought was that he had gone blind. The optic nerve must have been damaged in the collision, and the effect was only apparent now. But then he heard shouting from the corridor, made out the outline of the window, and realized that the electricity was down. He heard the chair scrape outside, and the door swung open.
Hello? Are you there?
A voice said. Yes, John answered, at a higher pitch than he had intended. I'll just walk around and see what has happened. Don't go anywhere, okay?
No, but...
Yes? Don't they have an emergency generator? I think they're for operating rooms and surveillance cameras.
I see.
John listened to the policeman's footsteps, fading away as he stared at the green illuminated exit sign over the door. The sign reminded him of Runhill again. That had also started in the dark. After eating, they had gone for a walk in pitch-black Fronja Park and stood in the deserted square by the monolith, looking eastward toward downtown. And he had told her the story about how Gustav Vigeland, the singular artist from Mandal, had made it a condition of his decorating the park with sculptures that the park should be extended so that the monolith would be symmetrical in relation to the surrounding churches and the main gate directly facing Oranjeborg Church. When the city council representative had explained that they could not move the park, Vigeland had demanded that the churches be moved. She had just looked at him with a serious expression while he was talking, and it had run through his mind that this woman was so strong and intelligent that she frightened him.
"I'm frozen," she had said, shivering under her coat. "Perhaps we should go back," he had started,
but then she had placed her hand behind his head and turned her face up to his. She had the most unusual eyes he had ever seen. Light blue, almost turquoise, surrounded by a whiteness that made her wan skin take on colour. And he had done what he always did. He stooped and bent down. Then her tongue was in his mouth, hot and wet, an insistent muscle, a mysterious anaconda that wound its way around his tongue and searched for a grip. He had felt the heat through the thick wool material of the suit trousers from Freytex when her hand came to rest with impressive accuracy. "Come on," she had whispered in his ear, putting one foot on the fence, and he had looked down and caught a glimpse of white skin where the stockings finished before tearing himself away. "I can't," he had said. "Why not?" she had groaned. "I've made a vow to God." And she had scrutinized him, puzzled at first. Then her eyes had filled with water, and she had begun to cry quietly and rested her head against his chest, saying she never thought she would ever find him again. He had not understood what she meant, but had stroked her hair, and that was how it all started. They always met in his flat and always after she had taken the initiative. At first, she made a few half-hearted attempts to make him break his chastity vows, but then she seemed to be happy for them to lie next to each other on the bed and just caress and be caressed. Now and then, for reasons he did not understand, she could become desperate and say he must never leave her. They didn't speak much, but he had a feeling that their abstinence bound her closer to him. Their meetings had come to a sudden end when he met Thea, not so much because he didn't want to meet her, but because Thea had wanted to exchange spare keys with John. She had said it was a question of trust, and he hadn't been able to come up with a riposte. John turned in bed and shut his eyes. He wanted to dream now. Dream and forget, if that was possible. Sleep was on its way when he felt a draft in the room. As an instinctive reaction, he opened his eyes and rolled over. In the pale green light from the exit sign, he saw that the door was closed. He peered into the shadows as he held his breath and listened. Martina stood in the darkened window of her flat on Sorgenfregatta, which had also been blacked out by the power cut. Nevertheless, she could still make out the car down below. It looked like Rickard's. Rickard had not tried to kiss her when she got out of the car. He had just looked at her with puppy eyes and said he was going to be the new chief administrator. There had been signals, positive signals. It would be him. There had been a strange stiffness in his expression when he asked her if she thought so too. She had said he would make a good chief administrator, and went to open the door handle while waiting for his touch, but it hadn't come, and then she was out. Martina sighed, picked up the cell phone and dialed the number she had been given. "Speak." Harry Hole's voice sounded quite different on the phone, or perhaps it was because he was at home. Maybe this was his home voice. "It's Martina," she said. "Hi." It was impossible to hear if he was pleased or not. "You asked me to give some thought to whether I could remember anyone calling or asking about the duty roster," she said. "About John's shift."
"Yes."
"I've thought about it."
"And?"
"No one."
Long pause. "Did you call to tell me that?" His voice was warm and rough, as though he had been asleep.
"Yes." "Shouldn't I have done that?"
"Yes, yes, of course. Thank you very much for your help."
"Not at all."
She closed her eyes and waited until she heard his voice again. "Did you get home all right?"
"There's a blackout here."
"Here too," he said. "It'll be back soon."
"What if it isn't?"
"What do you mean?"
"Will we be cast into chaos?"
"Do you think about that sort of thing a lot?"
"From time to time. I think civilization's infrastructure is much more fragile than we like to believe. What do you think?"
He paused for a long time before answering. "Well, I think all the systems we rely on can short-circuit and hurl us into deepest night, where laws and regulations no longer protect us, where the cold and beasts of prey rule, and everyone has to try to save his own skin."
"That," she said, when no more was forthcoming, "was not very suitable for helping little girls get off to sleep. I think you're a real dystopian, Harry."
"Of course. I'm a policeman. Good night." He had put down the receiver before she had a chance to formulate an answer. Harry crept back under the duvet and gazed at the wall. The temperature had plummeted in his flat. Harry thought about the sky outside.
About Andalsnes, about his grandfather and his mother, the funeral, and the prayer she had whispered at night in her gentle, gentle voice. A mighty fortress is our God. But in the weightless moment before sleeping, he thought of Martina and her voice, which was still in his head. The TV in the sitting room came to life with a groan and began to hiss. The light bulb in the corridor came back on and cast light through the open bedroom door and onto Harry's face. But by then he was already asleep. 20 minutes later, Harry's telephone rang. He thrust open his eyes and swore. Shuffled, shivering, into the hallway and lifted the receiver.
Speak softly.
Harry?
Just about.
What's up, Halverson? Something's happened. Something or a lot? A lot.
Fuck.
15. Early hours. Thursday, December 18th. The raid. Sahil stood shivering on the path beside the Akar Selva. To hell with the Albanian bastard. Despite the cold, the river was ice-free and black and reinforced the darkness under the plain iron bridge. Sahil was 16 years old and had come from Somalia with his mother when he was 12. He had started selling hash when he was 14 and heroin last spring. Now Hux had let him down again, and he couldn't risk standing here all night with his goods and no trade. 10 fixes. If he had been 18, he could always have gone down to Plata and sold them there. But the cops hauled in underage dealers at Plata. Their territory was here, along the river. Most of them were young boys from Somalia selling to customers who either were underage too, or had other reasons not to be seen at Plata. Fuck Hux. He needed the cash, desperately. A man came walking down the footpath. It wasn't Hux, that was for sure. He was still limping after the B-gang had beaten him up for selling diluted amphetamines. As if there were anything else. And he didn't look like an undercover cop either, or a junkie, even though he was wearing the type of blue coat he had seen many junkies wear. Sahil looked around. They were alone. When the man was close enough, Sahil stepped out of the shadow of the bridge. One affix? The man gave a brief smile, shook his head and made to walk on. However, Sahil had positioned himself in the middle of the path. He was big for his age, for any age, and his knife was too. A Rambo First Blood with a hollow handle containing a compass and fishing line. It cost around 1,000 kroner at the army shop, but he had got it for 300 from a pal.
Do you want to buy or just be up?
Sahil asked, holding the knife so that the grooved blade reflected the pale light from the street lamp.
Excuse me?
Foreigner speak. Not Sahil's strongest suit.
Money.
Sahil heard his voice rising. He always got so angry when he robbed people. He didn't know why.
Now!
The foreigner nodded and held up his left hand in defense, while calmly moving his right inside his jacket. Then he withdrew his hand with lightning speed. Sahil did not have time to react. He whispered a shit as he realized he was staring down the muzzle of a gun. He wanted to run, but the black metal eye seemed to have frozen his feet to the ground. He began.
Run,
said the man. Now. And Sahil ran with the cold, damp air from the river burning in his lungs, and the lights from the plaza and the post house jumping up and down on his retinas, ran until the river flowed out into the fjord, and he could run no farther. And he screamed at the fences around the container terminal that one day he would kill them all. A quarter of an hour had passed since Harry had been awoken by Halverson's call. The police car pulled up by the curb at Sofia's Gata, and Harry slid onto the back seat beside his colleague. He mumbled an evening to the uniformed policeman in the front. The driver, a hefty fellow with a closed police face, drove off quietly.
Put your foot down, said the pale young pimply policeman in the passenger seat.
How many are there of us?
Harry peered at his watch.
2 cars plus this one,
Halverson said. So, 6 plus us 2. I don't want any blue lights. We'll try to do this in a calm manner. You, me, a uniform, and a gun will perform the arrest. The other 5 will cover potential escape routes. Are you carrying a weapon?
Halverson slapped his chest pocket.
That's good, because I'm not, Harry said.
Don't you have your firearms license yet?
Harry leaned forward between the front seats. Which of you would most like to join us in arresting a professional hitman?
Me,
was the instant response from the young man in the passenger seat. Then it's you, Harry said to the driver, nodding slowly to the mirror. 6 minutes later, they had parked at the bottom of Heimdalsgata in Grönland and were studying the front door, where Harry had been standing earlier in the evening.
"So, a man in Telenor was sure?" Harry asked.
"Yep," Halvorsen said. "Torkelsen says an internal number in the hostel tried to call the Hotel International about 50 minutes ago."
"Can't be a coincidence," Harry said, opening the car door. "This is Salvation Army territory. I'll take a look around. Be back in a minute."
When Harry returned, the driver was sitting with a machine gun in his lap, an MP5, which recent regulations allowed patrol cars to carry locked in the trunk.
"You don't have anything more discreet?" Harry asked.
The man shook his head. Harry turned to Halvorsen.
"And you?"
"Just a sweet little Smith & Wesson 38. "You can borrow mine," said the young policeman in the passenger seat with gusto. "Jericho 941, real power. Same as the police in Israel used to blow off the heads of the Arab scum."
"Jericho," Harry echoed.
Halvorsen could see his eyes had narrowed.
"I'm not going to ask where you got hold of that gun, but I think I should inform you that in all probability it comes from a gang of gun smugglers, led by your former colleague, Tom Vola."
The policeman in the passenger seat turned around. His blue eyes vied with his fiery pimples for brightness.
"I remember Tom Vola. And do you know what, Inspector? Most of us think he was a good guy."
Harry swallowed and looked out the window.
"Most of you are wrong," Halvorsen said. "Give me the radio," Harry said.
He passed on quick, efficient instructions to the other drivers, said where he wanted each car without mentioning street names or buildings that could be identified by the regular radio audience, crime correspondents, crooks, and nosy parkers who picked up the frequency and doubtless already knew that something was brewing.
"Let's get going," Harry said,
turning to the passenger seat. "You stay here and keep in contact with the ops room. Call us on your colleague's walkie-talkie if there is anything, okay?" The young man shrugged. Only after Harry had rung 3 times at the front door of the hostel did a boy come shuffling out. He opened the door a little and peered at them through sleepy eyes.
"Police," Harry said, rummaging in his pocket. "Shit. Looks like I've left my ID at home. Show him yours, Halvorsen."
"You can't come in here," the boy said. "You know that.
This is murder, not drugs. Eh?"
The boy was looking with big eyes over Harry's shoulder at the policeman who had raised his MP5. Then he opened the door and stepped back without even noticing Halvorsen's ID.
"Do you have a Christo Stankic here?" Harry asked.
The boy shook his head.
"A foreigner with a camel hair coat, maybe?"
Halvorsen asked, as Harry slipped behind the reception desk and opened the guest register.
"The only foreigner we have here is one they brought from the soup bus," the boy stuttered. "But he didn't have a camel hair coat, just a suit jacket. Rickard Nilsson gave him a winter jacket from our store."
"Did he make a call from here?"
Harry called from behind the desk.
"He used the phone in the office behind you."
"Time?"
"About 11:30.
"Matches the call to Zagreb," Halvorsen murmured. "Is he in?"
Harry asked.
"Don't know. He took the key with him and I've been asleep."
"Do you have a master key?"
The boy nodded, unhooked a key from the bunch he had attached to his belt, and put it in Harry's outstretched hand.
"Room number?"
26, up the stairs, at the end of the corridor.
Harry had already set off. The uniformed policeman followed close behind with both hands on the machine gun.
"Stay in your room until this is over,"
Halvorsen said to the boy as he pulled out his Smith & Wesson revolver, winked, and patted him on the shoulder. He unlocked the door and noted that reception was unmanned. Natural enough. As natural as a police car occupied by a policeman parked farther up the street. After all, he had just discovered firsthand that this was a criminal area. He trudged up the stairs, and as he rounded the corner of the corridor, he heard a crackle he recognized from the bunkers in Vukovar, a walkie-talkie. He glanced up. At the end of the corridor, by the door to his room, stood 2 men in plain clothes, and 1 uniformed policeman holding a machine gun. Right away he recognized one of the plainclothes men, the one with his hand on the doorknob. The uniformed policeman raised the walkie-talkie and spoke quietly into it. The other 2 were facing him. It was too late to retreat. He nodded to them, stopped in front of room 22, and shook his head as if to show his despair at the increasing criminality in the neighborhood, while pretending to rummage through his pockets for his room key. From the corner of his eye, he watched the policeman from the reception line at the Scandia Hotel push open the door to the room without a sound, closely followed by the other 2. As soon as they were out of sight, he went back down the way he had come, took the stairs in 2 strides.
He had noted all the exits, as he always did, when he arrived in the white bus earlier in the evening. For an instant, he wondered about the door leading into the backyard, but it was too obvious. Unless he was very much mistaken, they would have placed a policeman there. His best chance was the main entrance. He walked out and turned left, straight toward the police car. On that route, there was only one of them. If he managed to slip past, he could go down to the river and the darkness.
"Fuck! Fuck! Fuck!"
Harry shouted, on finding the room empty. "Maybe he's gone out for a walk," Halverson said. They both turned to the driver. He hadn't said anything, but the walkie-talkie on his chest was speaking. "It's the same guy I saw going in a moment ago. Now he's coming out again. He's coming toward me." Harry breathed in. There was a particular perfumed smell in the room that he vaguely recognized.
"That's him," Harry said. "He tricked us."
"That's him," the driver said into the microphone, running after Harry, who was already out the door.
"Fantastic! I've got him!"
The radio crackled. "Out!"
"No!"
Harry shouted as they stormed down the corridor.
"Don't try to stop him! Wait for us!"
The driver repeated the order into the mic, but received a wordless hiss in response. He saw the door of the police car open, and a young uniformed officer step out under the streetlight with a gun.
"Halt!"
shouted the man, standing with legs apart, and the gun pointed at him. Inexperienced, he thought. There was almost 50 yards of darkened street between them, and unlike the young mugger under the bridge, this policeman was not canny enough to wait until the victim's escape routes were cut off. For the second time that night he took out his Llama Minimax, and instead of making off, he began to run straight toward the policeman.
"Halt!"
repeated the police officer. The distance had shrunk to 30 yards, 20 yards. He raised his gun and shot. People tend to overestimate the chances of hitting another person at distances over 10 yards. On the other hand, they often underestimate the psychological effect of the sound, of the explosion, combined with the pinging of lead against something close by. When the bullet hit the car windshield, which went white, then collapsed, the same thing happened to the policeman. He went white and sank to his knees, as his fingers tried to cling to the too-heavy Jericho 941. Harry and Halverson arrived on Heimdalsgata at the same time.
"There,"
Halverson said. The young policeman was still on his knees beside the car, with his gun pointing to the sky. But farther up the street they caught sight of the back of the blue coat they had seen in the corridor.
"He's running toward Eicher," Halverson said.
Harry turned to the driver, who had joined them.
"Give me the MP5.
The officer passed Harry the weapon.
"It isn't..."
But Harry had already started running. He heard Halverson behind him, but the rubber soles of his Doc Martens gave him a better purchase on the blue ice. The man in front of him had a long lead. He had already rounded the corner to Valsgata, which skirted the park. Harry held the machine gun in one hand and concentrated on breathing while trying to run with an efficient use of movement. He slowed down and got the gun into a shooting position before arriving at the corner. Tried not to think too much as he stuck out his head and looked to the right. There was no one waiting for him. No one to be seen on the street either. But a man like Stankic would hardly have been stupid enough to run into any of the backyards, which were rat traps, with their locked gates. Harry peered into the park, where the large white surface of snow reflected the lights of the surrounding buildings. Wasn't something moving over there? 60, 70 yards away, a figure making slow headway through the snow. Blue jacket. Harry sprinted across the road, took off and sailed over the snowdrift and plunged into it, sinking up to his waist in fresh snow.
Fuck!
He had dropped the machine gun. The figure ahead of him turned, then struggled forward. Harry's hand searched for the gun as he watched Stankic feverishly fighting his way through the loose snow, which wouldn't allow him to gain a foothold. His fingers met something hard. There. Harry pulled out the weapon and heaved himself up, got one leg out, stretched it as far as he could, rolled over, pulled the other leg, stretched it out. After 30 yards, the lactic acid was burning in his thigh muscles, but the distance between them had shrunk. The other man was almost on the footpath and out of the mass of snow. Harry gritted his teeth and managed to speed up. He put the distance at 15 yards. Close enough. Harry dropped onto his stomach in the snow and set up the weapon. Blew the snow off the sights. Released the safety catch. Selected the lever for single fire mode, and waited until the man had reached the cone of light from the street lamp by the footpath.
"Police!"
Harry didn't appreciate the comical side of the next word until he had shouted it. Freeze! The man ahead continued to plough his way through. Harry squeezed the trigger. Halt or I'll shoot! The man was only 5 yards from the path now. I'm aiming at your head, Harry shouted, and I won't miss. Stankich dived forward, grabbed the lamppost with both hands, and pulled himself out of the snow. Harry had the blue jacket in his sights, held his breath and did what he had been taught, to overrule the impulse in the cerebellum, which, with the logic of evolution, says you should not kill anyone of your kind. He concentrated on technique, on not pushing or jerking the trigger. Harry felt the spring mechanism give and heard a metallic click, but there was no recoil against his shoulder. A malfunction? Harry fired again. Another click. The man stood up with a flurry of snow around him, stepped onto the path and stamped his feet. He turned and watched Harry. Harry didn't move. The man stood with his arms hanging down by his sides. Like a sleepwalker, thought Harry. Stankish raised his hand. Harry saw the gun and knew he was helpless where he lay. Stankich's hand continued up to his forehead in an ironic salute. Then he pivoted and set off at a run up the path. Harry closed his eyes and felt his heart pounding against the inside of his ribs. By the time he had fought his way through to the path, the man had long been swallowed up by the darkness. Harry slid out the magazine of the MP5 and checked. As he thought, in a sudden bout of fury, he hurled the weapon in the air, and it rose like an ugly black bird in front of the plaza, before falling and landing with a gentle splash in the black water beneath him. When Halverson arrived, Harry was sitting in the snow with a cigarette between his lips. Halverson was bent double, holding his knees, his chest heaving.
"Christ, you can run," he wheezed. "Gone?"
"Vanished," Harry said. "Let's go back."
"Where's the MP5?
"Didn't you just ask me that?" Halverson looked at Harry and decided not to dig any further. Two police cars stood in front of the hostel with their blue lights flashing. A crowd of shivering men with long lenses protruding from their chests thronged outside the front door, which was obviously locked. Harry and Halverson walked down Heimdallsgatter. Halverson was finishing a conversation on his cell phone.
"Why do I always think of a line for a porn film when I see that?" Harry said.
"Journalists," Halverson said. "How did they get wind of this?"
"Ask the whelp on the walkie-talkie," Harry said. "My guess is he let the cat out of the bag. What did they say in the ops room?"
"They're sending all available patrol cars to the river at once. The uniformed division is sending a dozen guys on foot.
What do you think?"
"He's good. They'll never find him. Call Beata and ask her to come." One of the journalists had spotted them and came over.
"Well, Harry?"
"You're up late, Yendem."
"What's going on?"
"Not a great deal."
"Oh, I see someone has shot out the windshield of one of your police cars."
"Who says someone didn't hit it with a stick?" Harry said, with the journalist still trotting after him.
"The officer sitting in there. He says he was shot at."
"Christ, I'd better have a word with him," Harry said.
"Excuse me, gentlemen."
The throng moved aside with grudging reluctance, and Harry knocked on the front door. There was a clicking and buzzing of cameras and flashes.
"Is there any connection between this and the murder in Egatorge?"
one of the journalists shouted.
"Is the Salvation Army involved?"
The door opened a crack and the driver's face came into view. He stepped back, and Harry and Halverson pushed through. They walked through reception, where the young policeman was sitting in a chair, staring into space with vacant eyes, while a colleague crouched in front of him, speaking in a low voice. On the floor above, the door to room 26 was still open.
"Touch as little as possible," Harry said to the driver. "Beata Lern's sure to want fingerprints and DNA.
They cast around, opened cupboard doors and peeked under the bed.
"Jeez," Halverson said. "Not a single thing. The guy had only what he was standing up in."
"He must have had a suitcase or something to bring the gun into the country," Harry said. "He may have got rid of it, of course. Or put it somewhere for safekeeping.
There aren't that many luggage storage places in Oslo anymore."
"Think."
"Right. The luggage room in one of the hotels where he was staying. The lockers in Oslo Central Station, of course.
Follow the line of thought."
"Which line?"
"He's out there now and has a bag somewhere."
"He might need it now, yes. I'll call ops and get someone sent to Scandia and the station and..." "What was the other hotel that had Stankich on the lists?"
"Radisson SAS on Holbeksplatz."
"Thank you."
Harry turned to the driver and asked if he wanted to go out and have a cigarette. They went down and out the back door. On the snow-covered handkerchief of a garden in the quiet backyard, an old man was standing and smoking, while contemplating the dirty yellow sky, oblivious of their presence.
"How's your colleague?"
Harry asked, lighting both of their cigarettes.
"He'll survive. Sorry about the reporters."
"It's not your fault."
"Yes, it is.
When he called me on the radio, he said someone had entered the hostel. I should have drilled things like that into him."
"There were a couple of other things you should have concerned yourself with."
The driver's eyes shot up and blinked twice in quick succession.
"I apologize. I tried to warn you, but you ran off."
"Okay, but why?"
The glow of the cigarette lit up, red and reproachful, as the driver sucked hard. "Most criminals give up the second they have an MP5 pointing at them."
"That wasn't what I asked."
The muscles in his jaw tensed and relaxed. "It's an old story."
"Hmm." Harry regarded the policeman. "We've all got old stories to tell. That doesn't mean we can put colleagues' lives at risk with empty magazines."
"You're right." The man dropped the half-smoked cigarette, and it disappeared into the fresh snow with a hiss. He took a deep breath. "And you won't get into any trouble for it, Hole. I'll confirm your report." Harry shifted his weight, studied his cigarette. He put the policeman's age at about 50. There weren't so many of them left in patrol cars.
"The old story. Is it one I would like to hear?"
"You've heard it before?"
"Hmm. A kid?"
22, no priors."
"Killed?"
"Paralyzed from the chest down. I hit him in the stomach, but the bullet went right through."
The old man coughed. Harry looked across. He was holding the cigarette between two matches. In reception, the young officer was still sitting on the chair, being comforted. Harry motioned with his head for the sympathetic colleague to withdraw and sank down onto his haunches.
"Trauma counseling doesn't help," Harry said to the one young man. "Get yourself together."
"Eh?"
"You're frightened because you think you were a shot away from dying. You weren't. He wasn't aiming at you. He aimed at the car."
"Huh?"
The whelp repeated in the same monotone.
"This guy's a pro. He knows that if he shot a policeman, he wouldn't have a hope of getting away. He fired to frighten you."
"How do you know?"
"He didn't fire at me either. You tell yourself that and you'll be able to sleep. And don't go to a psychologist. There are other people who need them."
Harry's knees gave a nasty crack as he stood up. "And remember that higher-ranked officers are by definition cleverer than you. So next time, follow orders, okay?" His heart was beating like a hunted animal's. A gust of wind caught the lamps hanging from the thin wires above the street, and his shadow danced across the pavement. He wished he could take longer strides, but because of the icy, slippery surface, he had to keep his legs beneath him as much as possible. It must have been the telephone call to Zagreb from the office that had led the police to the hostel, and it had happened at such speed. As a result, he would not be able to call her. He heard a car coming from behind, and had to force himself not to turn around. Instead, he listened. So far, it hadn't braked. It passed by, followed by a rush of air and a flurry of powdery snow that settled on the tiny strip of neck not covered by the blue jacket, the jacket that the policeman had seen him wearing and meant he was no longer invisible. He had considered discarding the jacket, but a man in a shirt would not only look suspicious, but would also freeze to death. He glanced at his watch. There were quite a few hours before the town came to life, before cafes and shops where he could find refuge were open. He had to find somewhere before then, a bolt hole, a place where he could keep warm and rest until day broke. He walked by a dirty yellow house front covered with graffiti. His eye was caught by one word painted there, Westbreden. The West Bank? A bit farther up the street, a man was bent double in front of an entrance. From a distance, it looked like he was resting his head against a door. As he came closer, he saw that the man was holding his finger on a bell. He stopped and waited. This might be his salvation. A voice crackled from the speaker above the bell, and the stooped figure straightened up, swayed, and started yelling furiously by way of answer. His reddened, booze-battered skin hung off his face like the folds on a Shar-Pei dog. The man stopped, and the echoes between the houses died away in the night-still town. There was a low electric buzz, and, with some difficulty, he shifted his center of gravity forward, pushed open the door, and staggered in. The door began to close, and his reactions were lightning fast. Too fast. His foot slipped on the blue ice, and he just managed to slap down the palms of his hands on the burning, cold surface before the rest of his body hit the pavement. He scrambled up again, saw that the door was on the verge of snapping shut, charged forward, stuck out his foot, and felt the weight of the door trap his ankle. He sneaked inside and stood listening, shuffling feet, which seemed to stop before painfully resuming. Knocking. A door opened and a woman's voice screamed something in this weird sing-song language of theirs. Then it came to an abrupt end, as though someone had cut her throat. After a few seconds of silence he heard a low whine, the noise children make when they are getting over the shock of hurting themselves. Then the door upstairs banged again and it was quiet. He let the door close behind him. Among the trash under the stairs were a couple of newspapers. In Vukovar they had put paper in their shoes, since it insulated and absorbed moisture. His frosty breath was still visible, but for the time being he was safe. Harry sat in the office behind the reception desk of the hostel, with the receiver against his ear, as he tried to visualize the flat he was calling. He saw photos of friends stuck to the mirror above the telephone, smiling, in a party mood, maybe on a trip abroad. Girlfriends, mainly. He saw a flat, with simple furnishings but cozy. Words of wisdom on the fridge door. Che Guevara poster in the bathroom. Did people still do that?
Hello? Said a sleepy voice. It's me again.
Danny?
Daddy.
Intake of breath, and Harry felt himself blush.
The policeman.
Oh, yes. Stifled laughter, bright and deep at the same time.
Sorry to wake you, but
That doesn't matter. There was one of those pauses Harry had wanted to avoid. I'm at the hostel, he said. We've been trying to arrest a suspect. The receptionist says you and Rickard Nielsen brought him here earlier this evening.
The poor man without any outdoor clothes?
Yes.
What's he done?
We suspect he killed Robert Carlson.
My God!
Harry noticed she pronounced these two words with equal stress. If it's all right with you, I'll send an officer over to talk to you. In the meantime, perhaps you might try to remember what he said.
Okay, but can't it...
Pause. Hello? Harry said.
He said nothing, she said. Just like war refugees.
You can see it in the way they move.
Like sleepwalkers.
As if they're on autopilot. As if they're already dead. Did Rickard talk to him?
Maybe.
Do you want his number?
Please. One moment.
She was right. Harry thought about the man getting up from the snow. How it had fallen off him. The limp arms and the blank face. Like the zombies rising from graves in Night of the Living Dead. Harry heard a cough and spun around in his chair. In the office doorway stood Gunnar Hagen and David Eckhoff.
Are we disturbing you?
Hagen asked. Come in, Harry said. The two men came in and sat down on the other side of the desk.
We'd like a report, Hagen said.
Before Harry could ask who he meant by we, Martina's voice was back with the number. Harry jotted it down.
Thank you, he said. Good night.
I was wondering.
I've got to go,
Harry said.
Good night.
He put down the receiver.
We came as fast as we could, Martina's father said. This is awful. What happened?
Harry looked at Hagen.
Tell us,
Hagen said. Harry gave them the bare bones of the failed arrest, described the bullet hitting the car and the chase through the park.
But if you were so close and had an MP5 with you, why didn't you shoot him?
Hagen asked. Harry cleared his throat, but waited. He observed Eckhoff.
Well?
Hagen said with incipient irritation in his voice.
It was too dark, Harry said.
Hagen contemplated his inspector before responding. So he was out walking at the time you were entering his room. Any idea why a gunman would be outdoors when it's 4 degrees below and the middle of the night? The POB lowered his voice.
I assume you have round-the-clock protection for John Carlson?
John,
said David Eckhoff, but he's at Ullevål Hospital. I have an officer posted outside his room, Harry said, hoping his voice gave an impression of the kind of control he wished he had. I was about to check that everything was all right. The first four notes of London Calling by the Clash reverberated around the bare walls of the corridor in the neurosurgical ward of Ullevål Hospital. A man with flat hair and a bathrobe, walking with a drip on a stand, sent the police guard a reproachful glance as he passed. The guard was answering his cell phone, against hospital regulations.
Strandon,
hole here.
Anything to report?
Not much. There's an insomniac wandering the corridors. Shifty looking, but seems harmless enough.
The man with the drip continued on his rounds with a sniff. Anything earlier this evening?
Yep. Spurs got trounced by Arsenal at White Hart Lane, and there was a blackout.
And the patient? Not a peep. Have you checked that everything is okay?
Apart from hemorrhoids, everything seemed fine.
Strandon listened to the ominous silence.
Just a joke. I'll go and check right away. Stay on the line.
The room smelled sugary. Sweets, he assumed. The light from the corridor swept across the room and went as the door closed behind him, but he could make out a face on the pillow. He went closer. It was quiet in here. Too quiet. As though sound were missing. One sound.
Carlson?
No reaction. Strandon coughed and repeated the name a bit louder.
Carlson?
It was so quiet that Harry's voice on the phone rang out loud and clear.
What's up?
Strandon put the phone to his ear.
He's sleeping like a baby.
Sure.
Strandon observed the face on the pillow and realized that was what was bothering him. Carlson was sleeping like a baby. Grown men tend to make more noise. He leaned over the face to listen to his breathing.
Hello? Harry Hole's shout on the cell phone sounded distant. Hello?
16. Thursday, December 18th. The refugee. The sun warmed him and the slight breeze across the sand dunes made the grass ripple and nod in appreciation. He must have been swimming because the towel beneath him was wet.
Look, said his mother, pointing. He shaded his eyes and scanned the gleaming, unbelievably blue Adriatic Sea,
and there he saw a man wading toward land with a big smile. It was his father. Behind him, Bobo and Georgi. A small dog was swimming beside him with its tiny tail upright like a mast. While he was watching them, many more rose from the sea. Some he knew very well, like Georgi's father. Others were familiar, like a face in a doorway in Paris. The features were distorted beyond recognition, grotesque masks grimacing at him. The sun disappeared behind a cloud and the temperature plummeted. The masks started shouting. He woke to a searing pain in his side and opened his eyes. He was in Oslo, on the floor under the stairs in an entrance hall. A figure stood over him, mouth open wide, shouting something. He recognized one word, which was almost the same as in his own language, Narkoman. Then the figure, a man in a short leather jacket, took a step back and lifted his foot. The kick hit him on his sore side, and he rolled over in pain. There was another man behind the one wearing the jacket, laughing and holding his nose. The leather jacket pointed to the door. He eyed the two of them, put his hand on his jacket pocket, and felt it was wet, and that he still had the gun. There were two bullets left in the magazine, but if he threatened them with the gun, there was a chance they would alert the police. The leather jacket yelled and raised his hand. He held his arm over his head in defense and staggered to his feet. The man holding his nose opened the door with a grin and kicked his backside on the way out. The door snapped shut behind him, and he heard the two men stomping up the stairs. He looked at his watch. 4 o'clock in the morning. It was still dark, and he was frozen to the marrow, and wet. He could feel, with his hand, that the back of his jacket was saturated and his trouser legs soaked. He stank of piss. Had he pissed on himself? No. He must have been lying in it. A pool on the floor. Frozen piss that he had thawed with his body heat. He stuffed his hands in his pockets and began to jog down the road. The cars passing by didn't bother him anymore. The patient mumbled, "Thank you," and Matthias Lund Helgeson closed the door after him and flopped down into his office chair, yawned, and looked at the clock. 6. An hour to go before the morning shift took over. Before he could go home. A few hours sleep and then up to Raquel's. Right now she was probably lying under the duvet in the large timber-clad house in Holmenkollen. He still hadn't found the right tone with the boy, but it would come. It usually did for Matthias Lund Helgeson. It wasn't that Oleg disliked him. It was more that the boy had formed too strong a link with the predecessor. The policeman. Odd how a child could elevate an obviously disturbed alcoholic into a father figure and role model without any hesitation. For a while, he had been thinking of mentioning this to Raquel, but had let the matter drop. It would only make him look like a helpless idiot, or even make her wonder if he was the right man for them. And that was what he wanted, to be the right man. He was willing to be whoever he had to be to keep her, and to know who that was, he had to ask, of course. So he had. What was it about that policeman? And she had answered that it wasn't anything in particular, except that she had loved him. And if she hadn't formulated it like that, perhaps he wouldn't have focused on the fact that she had never used that word about him. Matthias Lund Helgeson dismissed these idle thoughts, checked the name of the next patient on the computer, and walked down the central aisle, where the nurses first received them. But at this time of night it was deserted, so he went on to the waiting room. Five people looked at him, eyes begging for it to be their turn, apart from a man in the far corner, sleeping with his mouth open and his head on the wall. Had to be a drug addict. The blue jacket and the stench of stale urine, coming in waves, were sure signs, just as sure as he would complain of pains and ask for pills. Matthias went over to him and wrinkled his nose, shook him hard and took a hasty step back. Quite a few addicts, after years of being robbed of drugs and money when they were out of it, had an automatic response if they were woken, thrashing out or stabbing with a knife. The man blinked and regarded Matthias with surprisingly clear eyes. "How can I help?" Matthias asked. Standard procedure, of course, was that you asked a patient this question only when you had privacy. But Matthias was exhausted and sick to death of junkies and drunks who took time and resources away from other patients. The man pulled the jacket around him more tightly and said nothing. "Hello? I'm afraid you have to tell me why you're here." The man shook his head and pointed to one of the others, as if explaining it wasn't his turn. "This is not a lounge," Matthias said. "You're not allowed to sleep here. Scram. Now." "I don't understand," the man said. "Leave," Matthias said, "or I'll call the police." To his astonishment, Matthias could feel he had to control himself not to drag this stinking junkie out of the chair. The others had turned to watch. The man nodded and staggered to his feet. Matthias stood watching him after the glass door had swung shut. "It's good you chuck their kind out," a voice behind him said. Matthias gave an absent-minded nod. Perhaps he hadn't told her enough times. That he loved her. Perhaps that was it. It was 7:30 and still dark outside the neurosurgical ward and room 19, where Officer Standen was looking down at the neat yet unoccupied bed where John Carlson had been lying. Soon another patient would be there. That was a strange thought. But now he needed to find a bed to lie in himself. For a long time. He yawned and checked that he hadn't left anything on the bedside table, took the newspaper from the chair and turned to leave. A man was standing in the doorway. It was the inspector. Hole.
"Where is he?"
"Gone," Standen said. "They came for him 15 minutes ago. Drove him away."
"Oh? Who authorized that?"
"The social worker. They didn't want him here anymore."
"I meant to authorize the transport. And where to?"
"That was your new boss in crime squad. He called.
Hagen. In person?"
"Yep. And they took Carlson to his brother's flat." Hole shook his head slowly. Then he left. Dawn was breaking in the east as Harry trudged up the stairs of the reddish-brown brick building on Gurbitsgatte, a short stretch of asphalt full of potholes between Kirkeveien and Fagerborgata. He stopped on the first floor, as instructed via the door intercom. Embossed in white on a pale blue strip of plastic on the door that had been left ajar was a name, Robert Carlson. Harry entered and gave the flat a once-over. It was a tiny, messy studio that confirmed the impression one had upon seeing Robert's office, although the possibility could not be ruled out that Lee and Lee might have contributed to the mess while searching for letters and any other paperwork that could help them. A color print of Jesus dominated one wall, and it struck Harry that if the crown of thorns was exchanged for a beret, you would have Che Guevara.
"So, Gunnar Hagen decided you should be brought here."
Harry addressed the back of the person sitting at the desk by the window.
"Yes,"
said John Carlson, turning around. "Since the gunman knows the address of my flat, he said I would be safer here."
"Hmm," Harry said, looking around. "Sleep well?"
"Not particularly."
John Carlson wore an embarrassed smile. "I lay listening for sounds that weren't there.
and when in the end I did fall asleep, Strandon came and scared the living daylights out of me.
Harry moved a pile of comics off a chair and flopped down.
I can understand you being afraid, John.
Have you thought any more about who would want to take your life?
John sighed. I haven't thought about anything else since last night. But the answer is the same. I really don't have a clue.
Have you ever been to Zagreb? Harry asked. Or Croatia?
John shook his head. The farthest I've been from Norway is Sweden and Denmark. And then I was just a boy.
Do you know any Croatians?
Only the refugees we give lodging to.
Did the police say why they brought you here of all places?
John shrugged. I said I had a key to the flat. And it's empty, of course, so...
Harry ran a hand across his face.
There used to be a computer here, John said, pointing to the desk.
We picked it up, Harry said, standing up again.
Do you have to go already?
I have to catch a flight to Bergen.
Oh,
John said with a blank stare.
Harry felt an inclination to lay a hand on the ungainly man's narrow shoulders.
The airport express was late. It was the third time in a row.
Because of a delay, came the brief and vague justification.
Örstein Ekeland, Harry's taxi-driving pal from boyhood, had explained to Harry that a train's electrical motor was one of the simplest things in existence. His little sister could make it work, and if the technical staff of SAS and the Norwegian State Railways were to swap places for a day, all the trains would run on time, and all the planes would still be on the ground. Harry preferred the situation as it was. He called Gunnar Hagen's direct line after they emerged from the tunnel before Lillestrøm.
Hull speaking.
I can hear.
I've authorized round-the-clock surveillance for John Carlson, and I didn't authorize his removal from Ullevål Hospital.
The hospital determines the latter, Hagen said, and I determine the former.
Harry counted three houses in the white landscape before answering.
You put me in charge of this investigation, Hagen.
Yes, but not of overtime expenses, which, as you ought to know, went over budget ages ago.
The man's scared out of his wits, Harry said. So you put him in the flat belonging to the killer's previous victim, his own brother, to save the few hundred kroner a day a hotel room would have cost.
The loudspeakers announced the next stop.
Lillestrøm, Hagen sounded surprised.
Are you on the airport express?
Harry mouthed a silent curse.
Quick trip to Bergen.
Is that so?
Harry gulped. I'll be back this afternoon.
Are you out of your mind? We're under the spotlight here. The media...
A tunnel's coming, Harry said, pressing the red button.
Ranhild Gilstrup awoke slowly from a dream. It was dark in the room. She knew it was morning, but she didn't know what the sound was. It was like a large mechanical clock, but they didn't have any clocks like that in the bedroom. She rolled over and recoiled. In the gloom, she saw a naked figure standing by the foot of the bed, watching her.
"Good morning, darling," he said.
"Mats, you frightened me."
"Oh?"
He had just taken a shower. Behind him, the door to the bathroom was open, and the ticking sound came from the soft, resonant drips of water from his body onto the parquet floor.
"Have you been standing like that for long?"
she asked, pulling the duvet around her more tightly.
"And what do you mean?"
She shrugged, but was taken aback. There was something about the way he said it. Cheery, almost teasing, and the tiny smile. He never used to be like that. She stretched and yawned. A sham, she acknowledged to herself.
"When did you get home last night?" she asked. "I didn't wake up."
"You must have been enjoying the sleep of the innocent."
Again that little smile. She studied him. Over recent months he had indeed changed. He had always been slim, but now he looked stronger and fitter. And there was something about his stance. He seemed to have become more erect. Of course, she had wondered if he had a lover, but that had not bothered her too much. Or so she thought.
"Where were you?"
she asked. "Meal with Jan Petter Sissener, the stockbroker."
"Yes.
He thinks the market prospects are good, also for property."
"Isn't it my job to talk to him?" she asked. "Just like to keep myself up to date."
"You don't think I keep you up to date, dear?" He looked at her, held her gaze until she felt something that never happened when she was speaking to Mats, blood suffusing her face. "I'm sure you tell me what I need to know, darling." He went into the bathroom, where she heard him turn on the tap. "I've been examining a couple of interesting property ideas," she shouted, mostly to say something,
to break the strange silence that had followed the last thing he said.
"Me too," Mads shouted. "I went to take a look at an apartment building on Göteborgata yesterday. The one the Salvation Army owns, you know."
She froze. John's flat.
"Fine property. But do you know what? There was police tape over the door to one of the flats. A resident told me there had been a shooting there. Can you imagine?"
"You're kidding," she shouted.
"What was the police tape for?"
"That's what the police do. Secure the premises while they turn the flat upside down for fingerprints and DNA to find out who's been there. Anyway, the Salvation Army may be willing to lower the price if there's been a shooting in the building, don't you think?
They don't want to sell, I've told you."
"They didn't want to sell, darling." A thought struck her.
"Why would the police search the flat if the shooting came from the hallway outside?"
She had Mads turn off the tap and looked up. He was standing in the doorway, with a yellow smile in the white shaving foam and a razor in his hand, and soon he would sprinkle on the expensive aftershave she could not bear.
"What are you talking about?" he said.
"I didn't say anything about hallways."
"And why so pale, darling?"
There was still a layer of transparent icy morning mist hanging over Sofienberg Park as Runhill hurried up Helgesen's gutter, breathing into her beige Bottega Veneta scarf. Even wool bought in Milan for 9,000 kroner could not keep the cold out, but at least it covered her face. Fingerprints, DNA, to find out who had been there. That must not happen. The consequences would be disastrous. She rounded the corner to Göteborgata. There weren't any police cars outside, anyway. The key slid into the lock of the main entrance, and she scuttled in toward the elevator. It was a long time since she had been here, and the first time she was arriving unannounced, of course. Her heart was pounding as the elevator was going up, and she was thinking of her hair in his shower drain, clothing fibers in the carpet, fingerprints everywhere. The hallway was empty. The orange tape across the door showed that no one was at home, but she knocked anyway and waited. Then she took out the key and tried it. It didn't fit. She tried again, but could only get the tip into the cylinder. Christ, had John changed the lock? She took a deep breath, turned the key around, and said a silent prayer. The key slipped in, and the lock gave a gentle click as it opened. She inhaled the smell of the flat that she knew so well, and made for the closet where she knew he kept the vacuum cleaner. It was a Black Siemens VS08G2040, the same model as they had at home, 2,000 watts, the most powerful on the market. John liked for things to be clean. The vacuum cleaner gave a hoarse roar as she plugged it in at the wall. It was 10 o'clock. She should be able to clean all the floors and wipe all the walls and surfaces within an hour. She regarded the closed bedroom door and wondered whether to start there, where the memories and the evidence were strongest. No. She placed the nozzle of the vacuum cleaner against her forearm. It felt like a bite. She pulled it away and saw that blood had already gathered. She had been cleaning for a few minutes when she remembered. The letters. God, she'd almost forgotten they might find the letters she had written. The first ones, in which she had written about her innermost dreams and desires, and the last ones, the desperate, naked ones, where she had implored him to get in touch. She left the vacuum cleaner on, draped the hose over a chair, and ran over to John's desk, and began to pull out the drawers. The first contained pens, tape, and a hole punch. The second, telephone directories. The third was locked, of course. She grabbed the letter opener from the bureau, forced it in above the lock, and leaned with all her strength against the shaft. The old dry wood creaked, and while she was thinking the letter opener would break, the front of the drawer split along its length. She pulled out the drawer with a jerk, brushed away the wooden splinters, and looked down at the envelopes. The piles of them. Her fingers flipped through them. Hafslund Energy, Den Norske Bank, Intelligent Finance, the Salvation Army. A blank envelope. She opened it. "Dear son," it said at the top. She continued to flick through the pile. There. The envelope bore the investment fund's name, Gilstrup Invest,